Hello. This week, Ofcom decided to consider issuing a statutory sanction against GB News after the channel was found to have broken due impartiality rules. Again. As Prime Minister Rishi Sunak has just called a July the 4th general election, the pressure is building on the regulator to ensure that all our broadcasters understand what due impartiality means, particularly during an election period. The print media operates, of course, to very different rules, and who owns newspapers still matters when the proprietors have clear political views which they wish to have communicated by their editors. The print media, of course, operates to very different rules, and who owns newspapers still matters when the proprietors have clear political views which they wish to have communicated by their editors. The Conservatives have always relied heavily on the Daily Telegraph, now up for sale, as the hard-pressed Barclay family scrambles to find cash. The paper is nicknamed, with good reason, the Tory Graph, and the Conservative Party has been keen to repel foreign buyers. One of the key backers of GB News, Sir Paul Marshall, is considering bidding for the Telegraph. So we could see, for the first time, a broadcaster owning one of the most important newspapers. Well, who better to discuss this and other issues than the author of You May Never See Us Again, The Barclay Dynasty, A Story of Survival, Secrecy and Succession. She is Professor Jane Martinson, Marjorie Dean Professor of Financial Journalism at City University and the former media editor of The Guardian. I spoke to her a few days ago. Jane Martinson, thank you for joining us. Actually, where are you joining us from?
I'm actually joining you from Singapore, from the amazing Bloomberg office, where I'm currently here on a sort of summer school program with my Masters in Financial Journalism students at City University.
Is that because you think the future, or they can learn more about the future where you are than they would back here in London?
No, not at all. But as part of learning about financial journalism, we are in a very fortunate position at City that my course is funded by the Marjorie Dean Foundation, set up by an amazing female journalist who was very keen to encourage the learning about finance and financial journalism. And part of that is to sort of engender greater understanding about trade links, so between US and China. And Singapore is so fascinating at the moment, sort of geopolitically and economically, actually, just in terms of the trade, the financial situation here. So they come for a pretty full-on week programme. And we're in Bloomberg listening to some experts here about how they do things and what sort of issues they face.
Well, I want to talk to you about the connections, financial connections, because in your book, The Barclay Dynasty, A Story of Survival, Secrecy and Succession, you talk about a tightly enmeshed web of influence between capitalism, politics and the media that shaped Britain today. And obviously the future of the Telegraph is crucially important. And it's linked to this man called Sir Paul Marshall, who happens to own GB News and happens to be extremely influential in Holy Trinity Brompton, which is at the heart of the Church of England, has extraordinary financial powers and so on. Now, I don't want to get conspiratorial about this, but if it is the case that Sir Paul Marshall takes over the Telegraph, how significant will that be?
I think anyone who takes over the Telegraph is going to be really significant. I think Sir Paul Marshall is a fascinating character. He's been, in the modern parlance, Roger, on a bit of a journey politically. As you mentioned, his faith has been an incredibly important part of this journey. He's written about it and how much of an influence has it been on his sort of dearly held beliefs, what he calls ancient liberties, which include freedom of speech, for example. I mean, his own political role has been significant already in terms of he started off funding the Orange Book for the Liberal Democrats, which really led to the rise, you could say, of Nick Clegg. But he's very much renounced that faith when it comes to politics. And in the 2016 referendum, he made significant donations to the Brexit Party and launched Unheard. And that, I think, is really key to this sort of what kind of media owner will he be? I mean, there's so much to discuss here. obviously, at this juncture, what's really interesting about the Telegraph is the fate of the Conservative Party, because no other newspaper in our country, in the United Kingdom, really speaks to the voice of the Conservative Party. There's a reason that its nickname is the Torygraph, as you know, Roger.
Well, Sir Paul Marshall, we understand, is going to make a bid. I think his spokesman said very carefully that if he did make the bid, he wouldn't use the Telegraph as a vehicle for religion, although, of course, he's attracted to the Telegraph because it aligns with his views. Now, you've mentioned it, very important, obviously, if he does get hold of it, in terms of the future of the debate about the Conservative Party. We assume they're going to lose general election. We assume that Rishi Sunak will struggle to survive after that, and therefore there will be, as people use the expression, the fight for the soul of the Telegraph. When we look at GB News, which he's very invested very, very heavily in and lost so far a rather large amount of money, what can we tell about his values from watching GB News?
I think the key thing is that obviously it's a very populist, very right-of-centre news organisation, particularly now. Although they have, you know, they were set up sort of with voices across the spectrum, but it's mainly right wing, including, very controversially, lots of current Conservative politicians. And it's been subject to lots of reviews by Ofcom, which I'm sure we'll come to. But I think at its heart is this idea that nothing is off limits. It's a real fight against what lots on GB News and Paul Marshall himself call cancel culture, against this woke idea that there are certain things you should not or cannot say. So freedom of speech, it sort of fetishizes the idea of freedom of speech, often over the idea of experts. So the sort of idea that scientism, I think, is a word that Paul Marshall himself has used in an essay he wrote for his own website, Unheard. The idea that experts in science should tell us what to do, that these ancient freedoms, the freedom of speech and the freedom of belief, should be affected by that. So I think that's quite telling. It almost transcends. I mean, we think of the Conservative Party. We're in such an interesting point, I think, in our politics. You know, we've had this left and right division. But really, it looks as though the right, the Conservative Party, and our politics is fragmenting. And there are voices within the party, which we would call it more right wing, but this idea of being sort of do what you like, it's a freedom to behave in ways that you should be allowed to, because why should anyone tell you not to?
And just briefly, before we go into those values, if Sir Paul Marshall makes a bid, is there any chance of the government stepping in and saying no? I mean, they're very concerned about certain forms of foreign ownership, which accounts for the reason for their previous takeover bids failing. They're not so bothered about the Times being owned by an American citizen who was an Australian, or the Daily Mail being owned by somebody who lives most of the time, I think, in France, or actually when the Telegraph was owned by people who spent, well, I suppose technically within the British Isles, but were in a particularly advantageous offshore position. Will they be likely to intervene at this point? Or if Paul Marshall gets the bid together, will it be virtually a done deal?
Just before I answer that question, the Barclays were non-domiciled for most of their ownership. Yeah. Just one of them, the older brothers that I write about at length, and that you may never see us again, came back in 2014. But they were very much sort of not particularly paying UK tax as UK residents. Will the government intervene in a Paul Marshall takeover of the Telegraph? There'll be a referral of some kind, because it's a sort of a newspaper of natural interest. There's a lot of interest, but there won't be the typical ways, either on public interest or competition and markets. His ownership so far of a television news channel and a website would not, no regulatory authorities would think that would warrant concern, unlike, for example, Jonathan Rothermere and the Daily Mail Group, which is a really big newspaper group in the right-wing space. So he really has an advantage there, the same as Rupert Murdoch. If you're going to ally him, as you say, the Australian, he would have an advantage because, again, he doesn't have that sort of competitive reasons to reject his bid. So, no, I can see that's why he's now really considered as a sort of front runner in this race. I mean, look, this is a race that no one could have foretold how long it would have taken Roger for a start, and also that we'd got through here. But he was a favourite in October when the book launched.
You're referring to your book, which is an extraordinary read, by the way, which I recommend to everybody. Mind-boggling. Sorry, I won't interrupt you. Carry on.
But he was a favourite in October because of these reasons, because he's very, very keen. And we could come to the campaign against the foreign state ownership, which you mentioned. I mean, this is where the government, unusually, and because Rishi Sunak seemed really quite keen for investors from the UAE to invest in anything in the UK. You know, the UK was open for bidders, for buyers, if you like, of some of its assets. But when it came to a national newspaper of the importance of the Telegraph, they stepped in and said no. This was after, by the way, the Independent and Standard, somehow the owner of the Standard, who is now in the launch himself, had managed to sell a significant stake of 30% to somebody, an investor related to the Saudi royal family and government. But when it came to the UAE and the Telegraph, there was an enormous debate in the House of Lords, with lots of great and the good former editors of the Telegraph, for example, saying no one buys a newspaper not to influence the debate, and we cannot have it nationalised by a foreign state.
Well, we certainly think Sir Paul Marshall wishes to influence things, and Christianity is, or his version of Christianity, is central to his beliefs. Holy Trinity Brompton, for those who don't know, is on the evangelical wing of the Church of England. It's based in central London. It has an extraordinary number of rich people as members. Its money has been greatly appreciated, shall we say, by the hierarchy of the Church of England, and there are claims that it has a disproportionate influence within the church, which makes it all baffling, since if you're a Christian, your essential concern is the pursuit of truth. That when one looks at GB News, the pursuit of truth is not exactly at the forefront, it seems to me. I've appeared on it and whatever, and that some of the journalists are very good, and some is very interesting, and there are some interesting points of view, shall we say. But essentially, it's concerned with almost a conspiracy view of the world. Plots, people trying to get you. They're out to get you. It's all of those horrible tropes that you associate with people whose primary concern is not to dig out the facts and then analyze them, but actually knows the truth and is going to tell you what to believe. Now, that's a very opinionated piece I've just delivered. Do you recognize any of that in GB News?
So what's fascinating, Roger, rather than perhaps agreeing with you as part of what GB News might call the metropolitan liberal elite that believes in such things as facts and truth, that we then want to share with other people and that make them listen to us, what the sort of founders perhaps of GB News and some of the people that appear on it would say is, well, that's your truth. What about my truth? In which case, you know, the conspiracy theories could be completely true.
Yeah, but the problem with all of that is that most of our discourse in the past has assumed it was possible to establish a bedrock of facts on which people could agree, at which point we can argue about how to interpret them, argue about solutions and so on, but we would agree on the facts. We're now moving to a situation where, as you say, people talk of my truth and your truth, or my lived experience, as if it sort of trumps reality. Sorry about the use of the word trump there. It was an unintentional pun. What's difficult to understand is how a man like Sir Paul Marshall can, to be absolutely honest, if he believes in the truth of the Christian message, there aren't other truths. There is truth. And I am baffled by what is then going on.
I mean, this is why this is such an important debate and such an important takeover bid, Roger, because, again, this notion that Christianity means truth. I would urge everyone to read this essay that he wrote in 2021, just 3 years ago, in Unheard, before he thought about buying the Telegraph, perhaps. But it was really about this notion of Christianity, not as you call it, this sort of notion of truth. But of course, if you think about Christianity, also it's a faith where they believed that Eve was born out of Adam's rib, and the whole idea of science, of Darwin, you know, we should question that.
Yeah, I think you're talking talking about a specific wing, I think, of Christianity, a great many people, Christians, would have said that, you know, of course, those are interesting stories which could train truths, but you shouldn't take them literally. But yes, if you believe that there is a wing of Christianity that believes it knows what the truth is instead of searching for it, and wishes to impose its view of the truth. But even if it's doing that, if you look at what Jesus said, I don't want to go too far down this route, but essentially Jesus himself, who at one stage was a refugee, who insisted on treating the Samaritans as equals, Samaritans to Jews at that time were anathema. I mean, love thy neighbor. All of these things come out of Christianity. And yet, if you look at GB News, you do get a feeling of, for granted, this massive threat of our culture being infiltrated by people from overseas.
I think, again, and I'm no expert on religion, Roger, I'm much happier talking about the media and the political aspects of this story. What I can see in reading what Paul Marsh has written himself and also actually watching GB News' content is, if you fetishise almost the freedom of speech and one's own belief over the notion of science and experts, isn't that at the heart of this? And isn't that where it also meets some of the biggest problems in media at the moment? So what is the call over fake news other than you, professional journalist, have cited a scientific expert for saying that COVID needs this response? How do you know? And then if you write what you believe, that then surely is a call for a different kind of faith and truth. And that surely is what we're really grappling with, something far scarier, which is fake news. The ability of people that do not believe the facts as presented. As you said, whether that's behind religion or whether it's behind public policy, if you do not believe, if you so doubt, which again, the sort of language of faith, if you so doubt about the facts behind, then you are sowing doubt about what you're reading. And that, I think, is the biggest existential threat to journalism. To leave aside the profit motive and the fact that the sort of internet has taken away the business model. I mean, this, if people don't believe what you're doing, what you're saying, what you're presenting as the truth, then you've got a bigger problem. And that, I think, is the really interesting thing about Paul Marshall's media to date.
And, of course, in these circumstances, broadcasting, which so far has been regulated pretty heavily, is premised on the idea that it should be not so much controlled, but it should work within rather narrower, if you like, parameters than some journalism, and that impartiality does matter. And we rely upon Ofcom, or have in the past, to implement that. In other words, at least to ensure that a range of opinions are expressed and that where facts can be demonstrably demonstrated to be false, they're not, you know, they're not developed and promoted. Now, Ofcom, it seems to me, over the past, a few years anyway, has been operating on the basis that we want a much more pluralistic broadcasting environment. Let's give those who are starting up and putting their money up the maximum freedom possible. So even when you get GB News, Paul Marshall's vehicle effectively, breaking the rules time and time and time and time again, we're into double figures, you find two things happening with Ofcom. One is they seem remarkably slow to investigate. And when they do, so far as I know, they have not imposed any penalties. Now, what is going on here, do you think?
So I think from what Melanie Dawes, the CEO of Ofcom, and others, senior members of the Ofcom team have said, seems to be a suggestion that impartiality is in the eye, if not of the beholder, then the organisation from which it comes. So the BBC, for example, is held to a higher standard of impartiality because of the BBC's funding position and position in the nation. Whereas GB News, which, and they have had regulatory verdicts against them for the number of, as I was saying, acting, actually ministers, you know, sort of Jacob Rees-Mogg has a regular show, as do many current Conservative politicians. if you believe that actually it's okay because it's GB News, it's a smaller channel, it's got a particular audience, it's a different standard of impartiality. That's a departure from Ofcom, and one which I know you, Roger, and many others have talked about before, and it's really, really important in terms of, you know, how impartial has Ofcom been, given the way that the chair was recruited, for example, and given some of the public statements that have been made?
I think the question that was most important to me is, what can the audience accept or believe? Now, there's been an argument with GB News about separating news and current affairs, and the argument it hasn't done so sufficiently. There's been an argument about whether it has a responsibility or the extent to which it has a responsibility for showing a wide range of views. And obviously, when two Conservative MPs interview their own Count Chancellor of the Exchequer, you know, people raise their eyebrows. But you could make a case, okay, they've risked their money in the market. They're going to put that out. There's nothing to stop people of a left-wing persuasion if they had the money doing the same. And anyway, does it matter that much because we have the BBC? Now, do you think, however, that there are groups of people connected with Paul Marshall or the Telegraph, whatever, who feel that in order to be truly successful, they have to, if not destroy the BBC, reduce it still further in its ability to challenge their commercial prospects?
Oh, I don't think that's just Paul Marshall in any shape or form. I think, I mean, that the view that the BBC is the problem to all commercial media has been in place for decades, as long as I've been writing about the media. I mean, Rupert Murdoch and his children have made no secret of their belief that it's the BBC's impact on the British media scene that has impacted on their profitability, even before the internet came along and sort of, you know, killed the business model. So I don't think that's specific to GB News and Paul Marshall. I think what probably is different is where you were talking earlier about people, you've got two sitting party politicians interviewing the Chancellor and it's all quite chummy. What I think the founders and the supporters of GB News would say, well, that's because we didn't get that before. And again, it's their belief that the media is all about one establishment view. I mean, it's really interesting when you look at the politicians that led both the campaign against the takeover by Abu Dhabi or indeed Michael Gove, for example. The language they use is very, very similar about against experts, against progressivism, as they call it. I think that's the sort of their argument, isn't it? That this sort of this audience, the unheard, you know, I keep coming back to the media Paul Marshall has already thwarted. I mean, The Unheard is actually a very interesting and influential website for its size. It speaks to a sort of a Westminster bubble, and yet its biggest audience are people within Westminster, and yet it's very much about not being within the bubble, about allowing other voices to be heard, the unheard.
I mean, I'm all for other voices to be heard, and there's a very good case to be said that the metropolitan liberalism, whatever you call it, has been too dominant, and unconscious prejudice has reigned, and that journalists haven't got out enough into all, you know, down on the ground, etc., etc. And there, you know, the interesting report for the BBC on impartiality, which didn't find bias, but did find a reluctance sometimes among journalists to look at some of the, if like, downsides of immigration. I mean, this is a really interesting, intelligent debate, which I think a lot to it, but. Well, it's quite extraordinary when you stand back and you say that people like Paul Marshall think that the general sort of reporting and assumptions that are made are somehow what liberal, whatever, when you think, hold on, you've got the Telegraph, you've got the Times, you've got the Daily Mail. Really? Are we to say that they're liberal? It's just bizarre to me. And of course, is it too conspiratorial to say that if you wish in the government and therefore and encouraging Ofcom to encourage and assist other broadcasters to come into the field of a right-wing perspective. It does make sense not to take the BBC cancel licence fee, but put a lot of pressure on the BBC, freeze the licence fee for a long period, make it make cuts so people say, some's almost self-defeating, you know, say, oh, well, there's nothing on, why should I pay the licence fee? Well, one of the reasons there's less on is because the licence fee has lost 30% of its value. I mean, you fit all this together, and I don't want to be called a conspiracy here, but it does make sort of sense from their perspective, doesn't it?
Yeah, you could say it's been a great campaign. And again, you know, I don't want to sound like a journalist who relies on facts, but if you look at the reach and audience of most of the British print media, it is dominated by newspapers that come from the right, that are owned by billionaires who are typically offshore. So in terms of a depth of argument and a sort of where control comes from, it is quite hard to argue that the left-wing sort of conspiracy. And that's why the BBC, of course, becomes this sort of target, because, you know, it's there to provide this sort of news for everyone. So it struggles with having a sort of, as it should not have a political view, because we all pay. It is universal. Now, if its funding, as it has been frozen, which is effectively a cut in rising interest rate and inflationary situation that we've had over the past 14 years, it has lost a huge amount of funding in real terms. And that means it is has got far less money to spend on actually getting on the ground, fact-checking, reporting done. Whether that's in London, in the UK, which really matters, places that were actually not heard as much as they should have been during the Brexit campaign, as you mentioned earlier. Or, you know, places like Singapore, where I am now, where we want to hear about what's happening with China. We want to hear about what's happening in the rest of the world. So this is such an important campaign. I mean, the one thing I would say, we're moving into uncharted territories, I think, in the British media, particularly because of what's happening with GB News and the broadcast space. Because broadcast, there are reasons that there have been laws against partial coverage because of the effect and importance of broadcast media. We're in a fragmenting world. Lots of younger people are getting their information online via TikTok, for example, though that's slightly overplayed, I think, by older media watchers like us. But they are getting their facts from different sources. Now, does that mean that we give up this common central ground, this sense of commonality in a community where we have trusted news providers? And the BBC still, every single survey, it always comes top of the trusted news providers. And if we allow that to be diminished, either by Ofcom or the government or attacks by right-wing media, then we will rue the day, I think. And I think, you know, for the common good, we should be acting against it. Can I just say one thing, though, on the whole issue of Paul Marshall? I think what he's done in terms of GB News, I think what's happened, it's really worrying in terms of broadcasting. The one thing I would say about him, which is really interesting, when you start to research him, and he was very unknown, actually, before the Telegraph and the GB News takeover bid. He's now using the enormous wealth that he's gained from being a hedge fund manager to become a media mogul. So what's really interesting learning about him is, until recently, he had quite a lot of public material. As I keep mentioning this essay, which, I, you know, it sort of shows his beliefs. 2021, just 3 years ago, that level of transparency, knowing what he then thought, his tweets, which, of course, we also, there was a sort of, he was tweeting these semi-private, not really, tweets in which accusations of Islamophobia, because what he was saying about Muslims and immigration were quite telling. At least we have that transparency. I mean, I would say writing about owners of the Telegraph who for 20 years owned a newspaper, were neither seen nor heard, you know, You May Never See Us Again is the title, because they literally disappeared, never wrote anything unless they were fighting with the local islanders in Sark. But they absolutely, their influence was wielded absolutely through a sense of what was and wasn't accepted. And there are lots of examples, whether that's not covering banks, that they, so the Telegraph didn't cover an enormous banking scandal. And we then discover HSBC, quite a large debt owed by the owning family. Now, that to me, that was in 2015. When that story broke, the Telegraph did not cover the HSBC scandal. Now, if we're saying that ownership has only now, with the rise of Paul Marshall, become an issue that we should be worried about, if we're worried about the media, we have not learnt the lessons of previous owners.
And one last thing, Jane, I mean, you're preparing, I know you've been heavily involved with women in journalism, you'll be aware how tough it is to be a journalist now, fewer jobs, more journalists getting killed, people short-term contracts. Are you still encouraging? I mean, what sort of world are you preparing your journalists, young journalists for? And are you saying to them, come on, it's challenging, but it's still exciting? I mean, what do you say to them when you say, can I have a real career in journalism today?
So I genuinely believe, I mean, call me, you know, an old romantic. I just think it's the best job in the world. But the problem is you don't go into it for the money, Roger, as you and I know. If you love, you have to be, and I say to my students, the financial journalism course at the City, it's such a brilliant course. And actually, the really good thing about it, particularly if you, you know, I'm very keen to encourage diversity, whether that's ethnic minority or socioeconomic, Roger, because sadly, this profession has become something you is really hard if you can't afford the fees. So, you know, whether it's through scholarships or the fact that in financial journalism, and here I am in Bloomberg, which has a brilliant internship programme. They pay good salaries. There's, you know, they have training, all the things that we should be giving to our new entrants into this profession, because training gives you the ability to tell the truth. Money allows you to give a level of independence. Having a sort of profession which is dominated by either people are relying on the bank of mum and dad, or who can just spew anything because they know it gets the biggest clicks. That's not what we want. So actually, financial journalism and all journalism, I still believe it is the best job, and the world needs it now more than ever. You know, in a world where we've got fake news and misinformation. And, you know, I'm in a place, Singapore, where press freedoms, my goodness, you know, we should cherish the ones we have and the freedom we have to tell the truth as journalists in the UK. And that's why it's so important to speak up about this and to sort of make sure that you want everyone to feel as passionately about the media as we journalists do sometimes. And I know that there's far, far bigger things to worry about, whether it's, you know, how much you get each month and whether you can afford your housing or to feed your kids. But my God, if we lose it, we're all going to suffer.
Professor Jane Martinson, thank you very much. And Jane's book, You May Never See Us Again, The Barclay Dynasty, A Story of Survival, Secrecy and Succession, is still available. And please do support our journalism by either a one-off payment on our crowdfunding page or regularly by signing up to patreon.com/bbwatch. That'll cost you £1.99 per month. And it also entitles you to my weekly blog, which gives my take on the week's interview, which might be interesting and might not. The link to this and our crowdfunding page can be found in the description of this programme. And that's it for this week. And as you know, this podcast is presented by me, Roger Bolton, and it's produced by Kate Dixon. The sound is by Dave Kitto, and special thanks to Quinn Genty. It's a Good Egg production. Until next time, goodbye.